This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, nearly anyone who's lived in this state for any length of time has a story to tell you about moonshine. For generations, the illicit drink was brewed in the nooks and crannies of North Carolina's landscape. The popularity of White Lightning led to an endless cat-and-mouse game between the moonshiners and the revenuers who raided illegal stills. Frank Stevenson Jr. is familiar with this chase. His father was a part-time deputy in Hertford County. Frank accompanied him on hundreds of raids. Frank and his co-author, Barbara Nichols Mulder, have written a new book called North Carolina Moonshine, An Illicit History. And they join me in the studio now. Frank Stevenson Jr., welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Frank.
Hello, Barbara. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
My pleasure. Frank, you've done it again. This is a wonderful history. Yeah. This is an amplified history because I know you've written one earlier. But let's look at the history of moonshine. And it goes back a long way in this state. A time when moonshine was even used as currency.
Yes. It goes back for 300 years. I mean, it has a 300-year history here in North Carolina, starting with the Scotch-Irish settlers in the mountains. They brought with them their recipes and their techniques in the same way with the English settlers who came into the Albemarle region, say, from the Jamestown section of Virginia. They brought with them the same thing. And over the 300 years, it became a way of life and a culture that actually is still ingrained in a lot of North Carolina things about the state.
And we think about it in terms of the mountains. We kind of think about it as Appalachian culture. But as you point out in your book, moonshine was brewed everywhere in the state.
All across the state. Surely the mountains had the history of probably making the most of it, but in just about every cranny and nook across the state of moonshine made from the Manio to Murphy.
And really unregulated and quite legal for a lot of the history, right?
Yeah.
And then what happened now? Because it was right during the Civil War that we imposed the tax, and that's when things changed.
Yeah, that's when all changed, and the tax on it, that's when the federal government put revenues out to try to chase down the moonshiners who were actually making it, selling it without paying the tax on it, and that's how the big game of cat and mouse got started, and then that continued up until today. I mean, once in a while, occasionally you will see a news story where somebody's been arrested for making it, but it's kind of a rare thing. Nothing like the years of, say, from the particular 1920s to the 1970s when it was huge all across the state, not just in the mountains, but it's in the central region, also on the coast.
And the initial tax was not very high, but then am I right about this? It went up to, and this is in the 1860s, $2 a gallon was the tax?
Yes, and primarily to finance the war effort for the Union.
So that's $44 a gallon tax current dollars, just to give you an idea of how this goes. So tell us about this, because you did go all across the state, and I know originally you wrote about moonshine in your part of the state, eastern North Carolina. What did you learn? Were there many differences across the state?
In some ways, there was some difference, but in the grand scheme of things, most moonshiners were alike. They basically applied their trade in secret and tried to keep from getting arrested and whether they were large or small operators.
And tell us about that, because there had to be a lot of techniques. I mean, first of all, you need water, you're going to need corn, you're going to need sugar. Those are a couple of things you're going to need.
Well, the basic ingredients for moonshine is, of course, corn or cornmeal, sugar, yeast, and water, those are the four main ingredients, and then you would use those in certain portions depending on how large a steel you were running at, what size quantity that you wanted, and of course the size of steels in North Carolina ran from little stovetop steels to the big factory steels that made hundreds of gallons a week, and compared to the little stovetop thing where you make maybe a pint or a quart.
And that's where some of the craftiness comes in to keep from being detected. Tell us what a big still owner would have to do to keep from being detected.
Well, let's take a look at one good example. In 1972, in May 1972, a giant factory still was actually raided at a small community in Bertie County at Murray Hill. And that's the oil had been operating for over 2 years. It was underneath a large hash trailer, and it contained four big tanks, each holding 4,400 gallons each. And it ran for over 2 years. The slops and stuff that came from it were piped out into a creek behind it, so that just disappeared into the creek. That thing required a lot of electricity, but the people who were running it, they bypassed the electrometer so as not to give any kind of an idea of what was going on.
And you had to use, if you didn't happen to have a house trailer to cover this thing, you would use rhododendron. I mean, the idea was you needed some kind of canopy.
Yes. You see, North Carolina had the perfect setup for still a perfect landscape. You had isolationist with the forest and then in mounts with a heavy rhododendron. You looked for a place that was secluded, isolated, not very accessible, particularly with... Well, smaller operators like to put their steels underneath a holly tree so that the smoke coming from the cooker and the boiler, the holly leaves would diffuse it, so it wouldn't be one big column of smoke. It would be just one. It would be fanned out.
And, of course, buying supplies was another giveaway. Tell us about how you first came into contact with the moonshiners. You were on a fishing trip with your dad, right?
Yes, I was about 8 years old. It was not long after my father came back from World War II, and we were fishing on the Meharian River, and fishing at the mouth of a small creek. And we were cane pole fishing, just the two of us, and we happened to look up, and all of a sudden, here comes yellow sugar bags floating out of the creek. And, of course, at that time, my father was he'd signed on after he came back from World War II, signed on with Hertford County Sheriff's Department, a part-time deputy, among the many things he did to take care of his family. And he was a farmer by profession. But he said, pull your line in. So we went up the creek, and they would find a small still on the creek bank. And of course, he destroyed it, took the copper coil. The copper coil, or what we call the worm, which is the condenser, that is the most important part of a still. We seized that along with some tools. There were some bags of sugar, and a lot of times we'd find sugar at still, and he would confiscate the sugar if the bags were still intact. Obviously, if they had been a hole in it or something and had ants and bugs in it, we left it. Hmm. And what he did with the sugar that they confiscated, and sometimes they were large quantities, I mean, 100 pounds, 200 pounds, 300 pounds, that's a whole lot of sugar. But he would take it and give it to needy families and the community where we lived.
Well, tell us a little bit more about enforcement, because it does seem to me there were a lot of stills that were broken up, coils taken, sugar taken. I didn't see a lot about what I would consider due process of law. What were the laws regarding enforcement?
Well, there was always this big game of cat and mice going on between what I call the moonshine raiders, which were ATF, ABC, and local sheriffs and officers who were constantly trying to break it up and trying to stop it, and to a lot of some of them had a lot of success, but a lot of the small time bootleggers who got caught and it wasn't a whole lot of them, but still there were some who did get caught. They would usually go before a judge and get a fine and suspend the sentence, and a lot of times the local the bootleggers knew what lawyer to go to because they had a particular lawyer had a history of keeping them out of jail was what the bottom line was.
But still, you could pretty much bust that up on the when you found it.
Yeah. You could take an axe and actually chop up the barrels and chop holes in metal barrels and then just what was usable we would confiscate and just take with us and
And Wilkes County became kind of not only the king and the largest producer in North Carolina, but you say perhaps in North America.
Well, that was this big squabble going on between Wilkes County, North Carolina, Franklin County, Virginia, and Cook County, Tennessee, as to which one was the capital of moonshine in the United States. And generally speaking, Wilkes was the one that was labeled that, and for good reason. They made huge quantities of it, and not only in Wilkes, but some of the people up in Wilkes, they were involved in big operations elsewhere in the state. For example, the the big steel that was confiscated, busted up at Murray Hill in 1972. That was a group of moonshiners from Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee, who set that thing up. And there were other ones that they set up. There was a big one in Concord and a big one in Wilmington and some others of the same design.
All of which tells us, well, and all of us, it tells us it was big business. It was part of economic development.
It was huge, huge.
Tell us about some of the characters, too, because there are some really colorful characters who have been involved in this business.
Well, there was a lot of different characters, and some of them became quite famous. There are three that come to mind. Because in the mountains of North Carolina, the name that comes up is a gentleman called Popcorn Sutton, and he was in Maggie Valley, and he had a long history of making moonshine and selling it, and he served a little bit of time in the federal prison, and then for it, and then last time he was arrested, and the judge gave him a sentence. He gave him time to get his stuff right to leave home and go back to prison. And Popcorn Sutton took his own life because he didn't want to go to prison again. But then, probably North Carolina's most famous bootlegger was a gentleman from Johnston County named Percy Flowers, and his empire, his moonshine empire, extended way beyond North Carolina. And on the coast, there was a gentleman named Alvin Sawyer who acquired the name of King of Moonshine in the Great Dismal Swamp. And Alvin made moonshine after World War II. He actually was a Marine veteran of World War II and a master welder by profession. But his real thing was he loved to make moonshine, and he made it for 25, 30 years.
Well, welding is the right profession, I guess, if you're going to build a still.
Yep.
And also, of course, Junior Johnson, who helped create NASCAR, which grew right out of the moonshine industry.
Yeah, Junior was, in growing up, he was a driver for his father, hauling moonshine out in the mountains and escaping the revenue viewers who after him, similar to the movie Thunder Road, but he actually learned his driving skills even a long time before he got his license, and then after all of that ended, he parlayed that into a very successful career with NASCAR, and is actually in the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
And NASCAR really got its start because not only did you need good drivers who could outrun the revenueers, but also people who knew how to modify those stock cars.
Yes.
You had to modify the suspension so you weren't showing that you were carrying a load, and also those engines so that you could run faster. Well, Barbara Nichols-Mulder, you co-wrote this book and did the research with Frank, and I wonder, Frank obviously has been in on hundreds of raids with his father, intimately familiar with the moonshine business. From that point of view, law enforcement, you weren't. And I wonder what you learned about moonshine, because I think everybody in the state's familiar with it. But what was it like for you, and what was new for you as a researcher?
I learned that it wasn't just contained to men. People from all walks of life made moonshine. Women, they had the children out there helping. You find a preacher once in a while making moonshine. And it's just everybody. I mean, you don't never know when it's going to be. It might be the man sitting next to you in church.
Yeah, and even a couple of nuns, I guess, Frank. Huh?
Yes, there was a case outside of Charlotte where in Gaston County in North Carolina, where a couple of sheriff deputies were raiding a still, and they were very surprised when they found that they walked up on it, and the people operating it were two nuns.
Racially diverse as well. This is
yes, it wasn't. It wasn't it wasn't a white thing. It wasn't an African American thing. It crossed all racial lines.
Now, what about what killed the industry?
Well, basically, what killed it was a couple of things. What was that? Of course, that was a steady drumbeat from ATF to really try to put it out and try to stop it, and particularly with the sales of sugar, to try to end that huge quantity of it. But the two things that really ended it was in the 70s across the state, the state ABC stores was opening up, and of course, it was a lot easier to go down to the corner ABC store and get your pint of liquor than having to go to the woods and make it and haul it out. And the second thing was that drugs such as marijuana began to be prevalent, and some of the moonshiners converted from making liquor to actually drugs because they found out that they could make a whole lot more out of a trunk load of dope than they could a trunk load of liquor.
So, it's lighter, easier to grow, easier to process.
Yes.
Well, how dangerous was it?
Well, in some cases, it was dangerous from several standpoints. One is to the people making it, that they had to be careful of how they fired it, because, if you got it too hot, the thing would blow up and explode. And, in fact, my father and I were on a raid, and we saw what happened to a man where it still blew up, and it killed him and actually blew his arm off and impaled him with a barrel stave. But also, now the people who raided it, ATF raiders and local sheriffs and all, they had to put up with booby traps, and sometimes they were shot at. In fact, my father and I were shot at twice during the years that we did, and obviously that's something you won't never forget. But in going in the woods, you never knew what was in them, and the poison snakes, stinging insect nest that you happen to encounter. It was certainly there were hazards to it.
Well, Frank, you've done it again. Wonderful book. Some great pictures in here, including a still that was exploded, but apparently there was one barrel that survived.
That's
a very cool picture among many. Thanks so much, Frank. Always a pleasure to talk.
It was always a pleasure, Frank.
Talking with Frank Stevenson Jr. and Barbara Nichols Mulder, the authors of North Carolina Moonshine and Illicit History, and you can find out more about the book and anything we talked about at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Will Michaels. Al Widarski is sitting in on the board today, and Brent Wolfe is WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.